So we'll talk about ultrasound imaging of molecular electronic wave packets, and it's a collaboration between two groups, our groups in Paris, Laboratoire Chimie Physique. So we are theoretician, we did the theory, and there is a very strong input from people from the CEA Saclay. So they did the experiment, and so they are the people who are working on it, so especially the group of Pascal Salière in CEA. Okay, so what I will talk about is molecular imaging, not of Santa Barbara, say in Santa Barbara, let's say. I saw it, this is really something close to State Street. I was biking around, and I saw that, I said, okay. Somebody is doing a business with that, this is too bad. So I said, okay. I don't know. It was on Saturday, so it was closed. So I didn't go to see what they are really doing there. But if you want, it's on Lavina, so 2621 Lavina, which is the parallel of State Street. So if you have time, I'm not sure that I will go there. So, but
maybe it can be
higher. I don't know. Let's say.
Are you getting rid of people?
I don't know. Okay, so what I will present, so this is really something, so it's both in the, let's say, strong field physics, and also what we are doing, we are using, let's say, perturbation theory and two photon transition and this is what we can learn from this transition, this two photon transition, and gives a lot of information on the physics that is happening in this interaction of a strong laser field with a bunch of molecules.
I will
talk about it for the rabbit technique. So I will shortly present the rabbit technique, and I will show you how we can recover some really useful information to reconstruct the molecular wave function. Okay, so. The first experiment was done in NRC. So there was a paper from Itatani. It's a Nature in 2004, and they reconstructed the wave function of nitrogen molecules with using the harmonic generation. Okay, so sorry, this is a bit too fast. So the idea they were using, and we are using also the same thing, is called the tomography. So tomography is a technique that is used let's say all around the world, especially in for medical imaging of the body. And the idea is that you will use, for example, two 2D projection of a three-body system, like a person, and then with many pictures of it, okay, you can reconstruct the 3D picture of what is inside the person. Okay, so we are not doing 3D, but 2D. So here, this is a tomography, this is a 2D tomography. And the principle is, in fact, it's not that difficult. For example, if you have an object with a weird shape, and you want to reconstruct this 2D, so this is a function of X and Y, and you want to get information of this X and Y, okay? And the only tool you have is to project the subject on a line. So this is a 1D projection. Okay, so you have X here and Y, and you have a line here, and this line is defined by theta, by the angle coordinate you along this line. Okay, and what you do is that you project you shine light, for example, or you make a projection along this line, this chi theta. Okay, so what you get is that you get a function with a width, and this function is p theta of the coordinate u. Okay? And this is the information you have. Okay? And what the idea is that how with this thing I can reconstruct the f of x of y. Okay, the 2D from the 1D information. So 1D, only 1D information, this is not enough. But in fact, there is, so if you use what is called the Radon transform, this P theta of u is a double integral dx dy of your function f, x, and y. And there is a delta function, just not to make a mistake, is x cos theta. Plus y sine theta minus u. Dx dy. So this is how you go from the function f, x, and y, the 2D function, to this projection along this line here. Okay? And in fact, because of this delta function, this is not easy to invert, so this is much easier to look at the Fourier transform of this function. So you get the p theta of k, and in fact this function is quite easy because it's f x y exponential I k x cos theta plus k times y sine theta. Just using the Fourier transform of the delta function. So with that, you see that if you know this p theta of u, okay, you make the Fourier transform here, okay, and in fact you recognize the Fourier transform of your f, x, and y. Okay? So the idea is that if you are able to measure for many value of k here, and for, let's say, all angle, if you know all value of k on all angle, it's just a 2D Fourier transform of your function f, x, and y. So by knowing p theta of k for all value of theta, so let's say 0 to pi, and for k from 0 to infinity, let's say r. If you know that, all this information, you can just by Fourier transform back get the f, x, and y. And this is used daily on this is for the 3D case, but this is straightforward to generalize to the 3D case.
Sorry, just to clarify this point. So this f of x, y is actually
the object.
Transmission function of the object to light.
This is a surface. This is the surface. This is not.
Right, but I mean, the only information you're getting is how light went through it. So
in tomography made with X rays, it's the transmission.
This is a transmission. Yeah.
It is a transmission.
Yeah, sure.
But it can be another signal.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Like what? Like what other than transmission?
For instance, harmonics generated.
Or
generation
from the two-dimensional.
Yeah.
Sounds complicated. What becomes the key element then in establishing this kind of spatial Fourier transform?
Here?
Yeah.
It's just a Fourier transform of the delta function, in fact. This is not that difficult. As a function of u. Because k, this is in the reciprocal state, this is the conjugate variable of u. So you just make the Fourier transform of u, So you have your function P theta of U, you make the Fourier transform of it, you get this function, and you can see that in fact this object is really the Fourier transform as as respect to the angle theta of your function f, x, and y. So if you have all value of theta of all value of k, you just make, you get all this this value of p theta of k, and you make the Fourier transform back, and you get your f, x, and y. Yes?
Do you need at this point already to make an assumption about the, if we're talking about harmonic generation, yeah, do you need to make any assumption about the nature of the rescattered wave? Is this somehow implicitly based on a plane wave?
It will. But it will when we make the connection between harmonics and the tomography. But here, this tomography technique is independent on whatever. If you know this P theta of U, that's okay. Okay. And so, in the first paper, so in this paper, in this Nature paper, what they use is, what they use is that they have, they register the harmonic generation from aligned monikers. So, how does this work, this harmonic generation, and why it is interesting? So, what you have is that you have a strong infrared laser. What I mean strong is around 10 to the 14 watt per square centimeters. Okay. Mainly people are using the titanium sapphire laser, which has a lambda around 800 nanometers. But now people are going to the mid-infrared. Okay. And so we heard a lot of this three-step model, so I won't talk much about it. But the idea really of this harmonic generation is that if you look at the light emitted by your ensemble of atoms or molecules as a function of the order is something like that. And you have lines and they are all harmonics of the main frequency and you have the cutoff here. And the plateau. Okay, and it's almost constant. The intensity of the harmonics are almost constant around along the plateau here. Okay? Yes.
The objective is to get f of x and y,
yeah,
isn't it? So you obtain it then finally by another Fourier transform, inverse Fourier transform, or
yeah, exactly. Your signal, in fact, your signal is p theta of u. Okay, or you can get, and in the harmonic case, and this is what I will show you, in the harmonic case, what you get, in fact, is directly the speed theta of k.
Okay.
Okay.
And they are related by Fourier transform with respect to, it was a real Fourier transform.
It's a 2D Fourier.
Now it's a 2D Fourier transform.
Transform with respect to?
Here, this is, going from this to this, this is a Fourier transform according to u. Okay?
Yeah,
so it's a ku if you want.
With respect to k to grant to f of x and y.
Yeah.
Well, you make a Fourier transform with respect to what you could call kx and ky. So k cos.
Yeah, yeah, sure. K cos theta. Yeah, k cos theta and k sine theta. They are related to k. So kx, ky. Yeah.
One more question. This spectrum comes from the ensemble of molecules, as you said.
The harmonic spectrum? Yes.
But you are imaging a single molecule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How would you reconcile this two? And the molecule can have some, you don't control the orientation on this.
Yeah, this is the line. It's a line molecule.
Okay.
Yeah. So here I just presented the principle of the tomography. Then I will show you I will present you very fast the harmonic generation and what is interesting with that. And then I will make the link between these two things. Okay, and we will see quite easily how to how does this appears, the connection between the two. Okay? So when you use a three-step model and Tony Saras presented us a nice formula, okay, what you can see is that your signal of omega, so this is your harmonic spectrum, okay, as a function of omega, you can write it something like that. So you have a function g of omega, okay, you have an omega power 4, you have a squared of k of omega, and you have a dipole squared, let's say, of k of omega. Okay? In these different things, what you have here, so this is the last step of the three-step model. Okay, the three-step model, this is first there is tunneling, which creates the electron into the continuum. Okay, the second step is the electron is driven away and back toward the nucleus. Okay, this is the second step. And the last step, this is the recombination process. Okay, and what you have here, this is the step number 3, here, this is the recombination. Here, this is the step number 2. So, more or less, the motion of the electron into the continuum driven by the field. Okay? And here, what you have is that you have the step number 1 plus some macroscopic effect, okay, like the propagation of the field into the medium, the generating medium, okay, because you have collective effect, like a phase effect, okay, and the detection effect, okay, so I will put it like macroscopic. Yeah.
John, I don't understand the macroscopic part in the tunneling. Wouldn't that be more?
No. There's g of omega. This is a mix of everything. There is the tunneling, and also there is a detection. I could split this g of omega like a gamma times another function f of omega if you want, and this gives you the tunneling, and this gives you the okay. They are both
phase matching.
This is phase matching on all these things, okay, and the detection efficiency
so
also.
What you have three there, that's the single atom dipole.
This is a single atom, yes, exactly. Okay.
Single molecule.
This single, yeah, it could be a molecule or not. But here this is, yeah. So you have the step 3, the step 2, okay.
What's on top? The A there.
The A there. It takes into account the, for example, the spreading of the wave packet, some phase effect that you could get on all the things. You take the square, so you don't care about, not too much about the phase. But this is really, it takes into account the propagation. For example, if you look at the Levenshtein model, this is the action of the integral over the action on the trajectory of the electron.
Exponential.
Okay. Yeah.
Is it completely clear that the macroscopic effects won't depend on the alignment angle?
No, it shouldn't. What? No, but the macroscopic effect shouldn't. No, this is just propagation of light into a medium, so that doesn't change.
Yeah, it's got to depend on angles.
Hmm?
Well, medium.
The index of refraction.
Yeah.
It's a very
I think it doesn't here.
In principle, but it doesn't.
You think it's a small? Yeah.
It's still good. People take care to control the density.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't see. Yeah. You don't see any effect of propagation in that case. So what we are interested in fact is really this thing here. Okay? So, and why? Because if you write this, okay, this V of K of omega, what is it? Is that K? So the recolliding electron, okay, is R matrix. And the ground, the wave function of your molecule, or your, of your atom, depending on that.
But I think you need to say precisely what you mean by psi, because I mean the wave function of the molecule is the wave function of the entire molecule. That's not.
Just a second. This is the wave function. This is the wave function of the molecule of the system, where the electron, from where the electron escaped.
Is the alignment in there? Is the aligned? Is this the psi?
This would be aligned, but
so psi is the wave function of the aligned object, right?
If it's a molecule, this would be aligned.
Yeah,
for sure. Okay. But this thing here, this is also true for an atom.
Sure. But it depends on the system.
Yeah, sure. This is the psi of the. If you look at one molecule. If it's aligned or not aligned, this is the wave function. You have your wave molecules, whatever the orientation. An electron escape from this wave function goes away, comes back, and we combine with this. Yes.
This is a one-body matrix element, so the psi is a one-electron wave function. So it's an orbital or something.
It's a wave function.
So this is already a very good approximation in many cases.
I will show you that we can see two orbitals.
You can see
two orbitals. Okay.
In N2.
Okay. Or we can see any orbital, depending on.
No, but. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
This is a one-body matrix element, and therefore psi is.
It doesn't have to be one. It doesn't have necessary.
Like you ought, it's one.
I could write a sum of all the electrons here.
It will not help if you don't change k.
No, but it depends. If there's k, it depends on what you call k. For example, if you say that the k is the ion times the electron going out.
But it's clear that if the electron goes out, in the meantime, the ion rearranges.
So
it's a time-dependent process.
I agree. This something can happen to the ion during the thing. What is really important is that what happens to the ion during the motion somehow has to be, coherent. Okay? So you, if, for example, you have a spontaneous decay of your ion during the motion of the, you lose the coherence, and therefore you won't see the signal on your harmonic spectrum. Because what is important is that this macroscopic effect is really important to see the harmonics. So if you have non-coherent process going on, so for example, if you start from one orbital, okay, and you end up, you can always recombine, let's say, to another orbital, which is non-occupied, okay. This is non-coherent, so you won't see it on the macroscopic response of your system. This will be because of this macroscopic effect. This gives you n square. When n is the number of molecules in your system, okay, in the macroscopic system, okay. So and if and because this is coherent, so if you have incoherent or no coherent process during the electron excursion, you won't see it in your. It will be completely okay. So if there is something going on in the ion, it should be coherent. This is really important. Okay.
But I think it is still true. If you have, no matter how complicated the ion is, no matter how many channels you have, if you have, just formally, if you have just 1K, which is a three-dimensional quantity, all you can get, so to speak, is a quantity as a function of X, X, Y, and Z. It's some reduced quantity. It can never be a many-body wave function that one can reconstruct. There's just not enough information to reconstruct more than some kind of reduced quantity, say an orbital or a one electron density or something like that. Any electron wave function can be reconstructed.
It depends on the case, I would say. And I will show you that we can reconstruct something coming from two orbitals. And we are helped because of the.
You can access more than one channel, of course.
Yeah.
More than one channel, but not say an electron wave function requires three n.
Sure. You can always, in principle, you can always reconstruct an object which is dimension of n square, where n is, say, if you access n channels. And you will always reconstruct some reduced object of the dimensionality n by n. So that's clear, right? So.
But each quantity that you reconstruct is basically a one-body quantity.
Not quite. Because if you access two channels, you also access interferences between them.
It's a
coherent process.
Yeah.
If you access interferences between them, you also reconstruct the orthogonal elements. It's a very important difference. You don't just reconstruct an integral over all n minus ones, you also reconstruct the orthogonal forms.
Yeah.
One body density,
one body.
Yeah, or if you have access to two channels, you should be able, in principle, reconstruct two.
Still a projection on two.
Yeah, it's a projection, yes. In that case, it's a projection. Okay. Yeah.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
Just for my understanding, for typical time that the electron goes back, goes away, and
it's around one femtosecond. Not more than two femtosecond. It's 1.5. I think it's at 1.5, 1.3.
About a half period of the field that's drawn.
Yes.
And the flip side of him saying that you can't see the incoherent processes is you can see the coherent evolution. There was an experiment with CH4, and you can see the atoms rearranging. There is information that's going on with some evolution.
Yeah, but it's coherent. It's coherent. Yeah, you can see the atom moving, for example. Yeah. But I agree, but it's still coherent. For example, if you have Auger process or, I don't know, spontaneous emission, whatever, you in that case, it won't work. You won't see, if it happens, you don't have the signal in your detector. This is something. So this macroscopic effects are really important to filter what we observe. Yeah.
You have, just to clarify this expression you wrote, you have one vector on the left, you have two vectors on the right. Is there some sort of a polarization dot product?
No. This is to give the direction of K. This is not a vector.
Plane wave and direction vector.
I will end up with a plane with a one electron on a plane wave to make the connection between this and this. But this will be and I will specify what I will talk. Yeah. But this could be, so it doesn't have to be really a one electron process. It could be at least many channel on two electron Okay? At least it has to be coherent. This is what is important. What's going on?
Yeah, I don't understand.
It's just an index.
There should be a vector over K of the magnitude.
For the notation here? Okay, that's a notation. It's a wave function, and it's given by the vector, what is going back to the electron. Okay, yeah.
So that should depend on the direction of K and the direction of the matrix element for each vector. So somehow D depends on more than just three components. It's a function of K vector then?
Yeah.
Okay, so now if we look at the molecules, because this is what we are interested in, okay, so what you can, for example, if you say that K is parallel, or it's along, you have, like here, you have a K cos theta and a K sin theta. Okay? So coming back along the theta direction, okay? And what you have here, you can rewrite this, and assuming that now your K is a plane wave, so the K is now a plane wave, okay? Now this matrix element can be really rewritten as on restricting to the one electron problem, but this can be generalized. You have this dipole here. You get K x cos theta, K y sin theta. Okay, you have x, y, and you could have z, okay, and you have f psi x, y, and z, okay. Usually what we do is that because the molecules we are using as a revolution symmetry along the z-axis, so we don't have the z here.
I can't see. What is the notation? Is 1e?
Which one? Oh, this is one. This is for one electron. Single electron process.
So this is across, you said cross section.
No, this is, I just assume that there is only one electron, this is a single active electron process.
Okay.
This is.
But what is the numerator? I still don't know. DE minus means.
What is D minus? Yeah, there is no D minus.
One electron.
One electron. This is one electron. Let's say single active electron.
It's not a numerator.
No. Sorry. No, this is single active electron. Okay.
And X, Y is what's left so far. X and Y is just dipole operator.
This is just a dipole operator. Exactly. And this is why, when you have the R here, this is why you have this omega 4, because the harmonic spectrum is given usually as a square of the acceleration.
I understand, but does it make difference if you write it in velocity gauge?
Yeah.
Would the result be different?
You have plane waves also. You have plane waves, this is not gauge invariant. Okay, you're going to get, and I will talk about the gauge if I have time. Okay? No, this is not gauge invariant. Okay? And in fact, what you can see here is that this expression here is exactly the same as this one. Okay? So, if you know the dipole here, by just a Fourier transform, you get back the psi x and y. But what you need, and this is really important, what you need is that you need to know the dipole in amplitude, phase, and also polarization. Or direction.
It's just to say that this, taking the inverse to a Fourier transform from this dipole, you get the wave function psi of x, y, times x or y.
Times x or y, so you have to divide by x or y.
So what would be your choice of origin? Because obviously the choice of origin for x and y is arbitrary, so...
You take it usually the center of your molecule.
What is arbitrary?
It is arbitrary, yeah.
The dipole doesn't depend on...
No.
Unless it's a charged system, the origin
If you deal with exact wave functions, then yes.
Yeah.
But you're dealing with a plane wave, so your result will depend on the choice of origin.
It's one of many problems of using the plane wave.
Wait, yeah. So are you going to talk about the plane wave approximation?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, maybe I'm losing track, but the symbol phi xy in the equation, I just misunderstood.
This is this one.
This is different than this one.
No, this is for the single active electron, this is the same.
Okay. So up there it's general, down here it's...
Yeah, this, yeah. Here is, this is whatever your function, whatever...
Some discussion here I missed where Sederbaum is asking provocative questions about things he worked out for us many years ago, the breakdown of the quasi-particle approximation and so forth, and so you can connect the two very easily, and his ball strengths come in. Mm.
Okay.
Well, maybe you forgot what you did a long time ago.
Well, to say you're measuring an orbital, it's making an independent electron approximation.
Koopmans. This is, in fact, this is the isom orbital.
So the ball strength is unity on the one
particle. Yeah. Okay. So, Now, you need to know the three quantities and for all angles. So you have to align the molecules and you have to measure the three quantities. Okay? In the Itatani experiment, they had only the amplitude, and this is not totally clear in the paper, but probably the polarization, but this is not completely clear. There is one sentence. And I heard them and they were not really clear on that point. So maybe Sergei can assess what they had exactly, but I think they had only the amplitude. They only had, but there is a sentence in the paper that they talk about the polarization. Okay? So the problem is that you have to assume what is a phase. Okay? And what they assume is that they had a minimum for the amplitude. Okay, and so they assume that at the minimum there is a jump of pi for the phase. So they use constant phase except when they add the minimum, and after the minimum, so it's zero at the minimum, and there is a jump of pi after the minimum. So this is what they use. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just need a little more clarification.
Yeah.
Normally you write dipole as the projection of coordinate vector times polarization vector.
Yeah.
For instance, if it's linear polarized, then you have Z, not R. But for arbitrary polarization, you just write it as a product of...
No, but what you have is that your molecule is aligned like that, and you assume that the electron is living along...
I'm talking about the operator itself.
The what?
The operator is normally written as the product of R times E, where E is polarization vector of light.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So this is exactly what you get out.
This is what you get out, yeah.
I see. Okay. I understand.
Okay.
In principle, this is in a sense related to what we discussed in week two, right? Even though it was not treated that way, but in a sense, if one could apply certain physical conditions on psi, then one can use phase retrieval strategies that are used for densities. The problem is only that it's not a positive definite quantity.
Yeah,
so I'm not
it's not positive. The wave function is not positive at all.
The hyperharmonic is that we can actually measure every quantity which he's talking about.
No, I understand that, but at the time, when only the amplitude was measured, it was basically a phase retrieval problem. Yeah. Like the same kind of phase retrieval problem that one has in current diffractive imaging.
Yeah, so the wave function is not positive. So you don't have...
That's the problem.
That's the problem.
Not
the problem.
It's probably
yeah.
not really invertible.
Yeah.
And this is finite support.
Which also finite...
Yeah, but if you say the finite support, you just have... Yeah, it doesn't have the finite support. Yeah, that's helped a lot. Okay? So... And you also need the alignment, okay, which is important. Okay, so what I will talk now is how we can measure. So what is also important is that you don't get your signal is this one, for example, and with that you get the amplitude. You take just, but you have all this mess around. In front of this dipole. Okay? Yes, sir.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah.
this expression, strictly speaking, assumes that your alignment distribution is infinitely narrow. So if it is not infinitely narrow, then you have to sum up coherently over all the alignments and then square, take the square modulus. Well, what you're doing is, what I think you're going to do, you're going to take the square modulus here, okay, and then average over Lyman distributions, which is not the same, especially when the Lyman distributions are quite wide.
Yeah, but not that much.
So, well, the Lyman distributions in good experiments are
10
about
degrees.
15 to 20 degrees from the nominal direction, which is not small.
Yeah.
So how much of an error will you be making? So
we haven't checked for that, really. I can't tell you. But it's true that we took the square root, yeah.
So an error in what would you be referring to?
So, His observable, strictly speaking, is not what he has written there. His observable.
There is an integral over the...
No. That would have been nice. So his observable is this. So so it's some different g. So with amplitude g.
Break the choke.
Okay.
Break the choke.
Okay. But then. The whole thing multiplied by the Lyman distribution.
I was deciding those cross models.
Break the choke.
Okay. So this is what he's measuring.
Yeah, I agree.
So this is the Lyman distribution of a molecule. But what his theory goes about is this point, right? So this thing.
Times the square root of the thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not about the same quantity.
Okay. I would assume if you do a Taylor expansion that they are similar, and so in that sense it blurs it out.
They would be similar if you had no phase dependence in if you only had the amplitude duration.
Yeah, since but you have phase.
When they add up coherently, then the effect is much bigger than you would expect if you had real quantity.
Quantitative issue.
Yeah.
So I think you're saying maybe that it's more complicated. You're not just getting the Koopman approximation works. You're not just getting a little mutation of the orbital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get some coherence.
It's a little more complicated.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, maybe just for the benefit of people who are not in the field, you could just briefly say how you align the molecules in the gas phase.
I will. Don't worry, I will. Okay? So this could be a problem. Yeah, especially with the phase variation we have as a function of the angle. Yeah, you're right. Okay. Okay, so what is important is to have the three quantities, and especially the problem is, so the amplitude is sort of, let's say, okay, see, if we say that this quantity is equal to this one, okay, which is not true, I agree, but you just take, so, no, it's not that easy because you have to get rid of all this term here, the one, the macroscopic, and the two, okay, so what we use, usually, is we use an atom which has the same properties as the molecule. So especially the ionization potential. Okay. So for that, we could say that the tunneling rate, which depends mostly on the ionization potential, okay, will be the same. So the macroscopic, this is the same detector, so and there is the same density, and if there is no dichroism in the propagation, this will be cancelled, okay? And on the propagation into the continuum will be the same, okay? Yeah.
So what do you do with those molecules for which the ionization is not only determined by the ionization potential?
In the tunneling regimes, it's, yeah, you don't use them. And if you don't have a rare gas which has the same ionization potential, you don't use them.
No, but there are also responses not only to term body ionization.
Yes.
If you have suppressed ionization like in oxygen, you would be in trouble.
It's
unclear then how to eliminate that.
This method, I think, doesn't work for any molecules. If you want to use the big molecules, you want to construct the even the Koopman's wave function. It won't work.
No, pragmatically, it's clear how you do that. So you measure, all you have to do is to measure ionization rates for all possible ionizations.
Yeah, sure.
And plug it in and assume that the propagation part remains the same, that the only thing which gets modified is the tunneling.
Yeah, but you don't have this a squared.
A given system.
So yeah, for a given system. Yeah, yeah.
Experiment.
But a function of anger, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Not on the reference.
You'll also measure the reference, of course, just to be safe, right?
Yeah, but you need a reference. So you don't always have a reference. You don't always have a reference.
Well, actually, you would measure ionization rates as a functional ionization, but it's not the same ionization rate. That's a problem, right? But you hope that those two are proportional and pray that everything works.
Yeah, sure. You have to pray. No, but the problem is that you need a reference atom at least to get rid of that. If you don't want to put too much, let's say, theory in the because, for example, you can compute the wave function, I would say. Even the one electron wave function, you can compute it. But the difficulty is to get it from the experiment. So, for example, this term here, this is rather difficult to get rid of it. So you need a reference atom. You could compute it if you want, but in that case, you put too much, I would say, theory in your reconstruction. Okay? So this is why you need a reference atom to get rid of all these things and end up only with this term here.
And just to make it clear, to get a good tunneling rate is functional with orbital, you need to know the orbital. So if you know the orbital, why do you do it?
Yeah, sure. No, but you always know the orbital. Alejandro, you always know the orbitals. You just take a quantum chemistry course and you have the orbitals.
Wait, this is dangerous what you said, because there are many, many definitions to call it. Corn orbitals,
Dyson orbital.
The list is very long.
Yeah.
So maybe they want to decide which of these orbitals.
It's quite difficult to decide which one is right.
As long as we're piling on, would this system be very resistant if it turns out that more than one orbital was ionizing and there was an unknown phase relation between? That if you just in principle you have an electron ionizing from an orbital, but you don't particularly know what it is. Like say you have a hydrocarbon and you have lots of orbitals, they're almost degenerate, and you could.
If there is no relation, no symmetry, and I will show you that we can, in that case, we with the symmetry, we can recover the HOMO on the HOMO minus one. So, yeah. But we are helped with the symmetry and for some time delay between the two orbitals. But it's true that if you are mixing them, you don't see anything. And I will, so in the Itatani experiment, what they had is that, so with this method, they got the dipole, the amplitude of the dipole, and by just saying that the phase is zero before the minimum and then pi after the minimum, they had a dipole which is real. So by Fourier inversion, they had an orbital which is real. Okay, in that case, due to symmetry, they impose the symmetry. Okay, but and I will show you that the amplitude, the phase of the dipole is not at all zero or pi. Okay,
because what we were finding with nitrogen when we were looking at the ionization from it is that the amplitude of the HOMO minus one is maybe even 10% as large.
I will show you. Okay?
This is all in your formalism already. In the very top, in the second board, the K vector is a multi-channel scattering function. So
yeah.
It has all the channels.
Yeah.
And it's so formally, this is all in there.
It's all in there. If you to say okay, we will see one of these all, you have to make sort of single active electron. But in the process, you will see many orbitals. And if they are really close, or they are degenerate, or I don't know, that's one of the main problems with this tomography of the imaging of orbitals is that it works, but it doesn't work always. And you need a bit of help, from as Sergei said, you have to pray that it works.
The expression also explains what the orbital is that you're measuring, because you always have the projection of the ionic state.
Yeah, so this is more or less, this is a Dyson orbital.
And
this
so
is,
you
yeah.
have that
overlap
factor,
yeah.
which is the orbital.
This is a Dyson orbital.
Yeah.
In fact,
not general, it's a Dyson.
But you see, as soon as you make the plane wave approximation, it makes no sense to insist that this is a Dyson orbital, because basically you're making the error.
No.
You could even argue that the error appears early if one does.
No. Just a second. You have to make you could use a scattering wave here, but if you use a scattering wave for the K, which you are supposed on Zach did it with Chris. The problem is that when you do the inversion, you got a problem, because you don't end up with such an easy formula, which show you that this is a Fourier transform of your wave function. The problem is that you can always compute with the scattering wave. Okay, if you can do the tomography, and we did it with the plane wave, but you can do the tomography process. Okay, theoretically. You have your orbital, whatever the orbital you are using. Let's say this is the HOMO coming from a quantum chemistry code. Okay, you can compute this dipole. Okay, with the scattering wave, and now decide to make the Fourier transform back of this object.
The reason why I'm saying that one cannot separate these things is because it's the Coulomb interactions among the particles that lead to the deviation for the plane wave,
yeah.
and also lead to the deviation from a one-particle model.
Yeah.
So in other words, if one evaluates this in a perturbative sense, one finds that actually the leading corrections first affect the plane wave, basically the orthogonality that the plane
yeah,
wave
yeah.
has.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Before one even notices the difference between a Hartree-Fock orbital and a Dyson.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. The plane wave is a very strong approximation.
Especially for these energies.
Right.
Yeah, but it doesn't. The thing is that I will show you why I think it works more or less in the region we are working on. Okay, and so now the problem is that we have to measure both. Okay, the amplitude is, as I said, if you use this reference atom, you get the amplitude. Okay, now you have to measure the phase. And the phase of the dipole, the phase of the harmonics is not that easy. Okay, and so the idea we proposed and was used in 2001 by Agostini et al. To measure the first attosecond pulse. Okay, so it's based on this two color ionization. Okay, so here what you have is that you have the harmonic generation, which is sort of a theoretical experimental scheme of harmonic generation. So you have your IR here, you have your gas, your generating gas, and this is your harmonic, okay, with different color. Okay, so this is the generation. And the idea we had at the beginning is that, okay, suppose that we have a very good selection of the harmonic. Okay? So we select only one of this. So with that, and then we use this harmonic to ionize another gas, another atom. Okay, and we use this as a detection. So what you will get if you use a high enough harmonic, you get the one photon ionization. okay, and you get a spectrum which gives you just the position. You have the photoelectron with the right energy, which is the energy of your photon minus the potential ionization potential. Okay, now what we propose is that suppose that we can take a small part of the generating laser and we combine it here on the detection. What will happen? So this is what we call what everybody calls two color ionization. So you can absorb the harmonics and absorb one or two or three, whatever, or emit stimulated emission, one or two or three, whatever, photon from the ray. Okay? And you get the main peak and what is called the sidons. Okay? And in fact, so this is what we propose, and they use it. Okay, this is I'll show you this after. And in fact, this scheme, the way we see the experiment, is not that different to what they did really. It's more complicated because they have much more mirrors. It's hard to align on all the things, but it's not that different. And I will show you how it works. And the idea behind what is called the rabbit technique to measure the phase of the harmonics and therefore the phase of the dipole is that suppose now instead of having of selecting only one harmonic, okay, so you have omega 2 q plus minus 1, you have two of these, omega 2 q. Okay, so you have two harmonics. So this is the same thing. So what you will end up for your photoelectron spectrum, you get two peaks, one corresponding to this energy, and the other one corresponding to this other energy. Okay. But now if you add the infrared laser, what you get, you can have in between the sidon, and the sidon comes from two paths. The omega, the 2q minus 1 plus 1, and the 2q plus 1 minus 1. Okay, so you get interference of these two paths. And if you use you have the interference between the two, and you can show that the signal of your 2q, you have a constant term, let's say A plus B times the cosine, you have a 2 omega laser tau plus phi 2q plus 1 q minus 1 plus there is what we call delta theta. Okay? So you get oscillation. And the oscillation depends on three. Yeah, just a second, Alpha. Just give me time. Tau is time. Okay? Just a second. Let me finish my sentence, please. This depends on three quantities. Okay? The first one, there's omega L, so this is the frequency of your infrared, and you have tau, okay? Tau, this is the time delay, this is the delay between the infrared laser, the small, let's say the small one and the big one. What I call the small one and the big one, in that here this is the big one, so the generating laser, and the what we call the dressing laser, okay? You can play with the delay between, you can play with the path here, so you have a delay, okay? What you have here is that the phase difference of your two harmonics, OK? okay, that's ionized. And you have this term here, and this is called, depending on what on your system, but you can call it atomic or molecular phase difference. And this comes from where? This is a two-photon process, okay? So if you write in the perturbative regime, because both the harmonics intensity and the dressing field intensity is small, you have to compute something like that, as we saw already. So you have K here, you have your dipole, you have your intermediate state, your dipole, your ground state, I plus omega H minus En, okay, and you have the same with, let's say, you get a minus, depending on which, it's plus omega H 2Q plus or minus 1, depending on the way. And you also have, but this term can be almost neglected because this is small, omega. You have the two path, because you can also have, for example, the absorption of one infrared and omega 2Q minus 1.
Okay.
Yes?
Now, if you are treating the infrared,
yes,
in perturbation theory, this means that the intensity must be such that you don't have extensive sidebands.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you have just once.
Yeah. Usually the dressing intensity is of the order of 10 to the 11 watt per square centimeters.
So it's the low intensity limit of the Bessel functions that come.
This is exactly. Yeah. But you this is really small, and they really, in fact, what you can see that if you go to higher intensity of your dressing, what you will see that this will add other terms here,
right.
And you see in the oscillation of your sidebands, not a cosine 2 omega L tau behavior, but you have something like 4 omega L tau or 6 omega L tau, depending on your, so it's getting bigger and bigger, but if you are careful enough, you have only one sideband from your dressing field, and the second order perturbation theory is working well. And so this quantity here as a phase, okay, as Alfred or Peter or Tony that they talked about, there is a phase here because you, for example, if you look at that, this term here, the intermediate state is in the continuum, and you get this minus I pi delta for the imaginary part, so you get a phase, and this phase here has to be included there. This is a phase difference between these two matrix elements. Okay? And in most of the case, especially for atoms, this phase difference, the phase is not always small, but the phase difference is rather small, and this can be computed. Okay, but also, let's say we discarded it. But in the way we reconstruct the harmonic phase, we computed these things. Okay, but this is rather small. Okay.
This Q dependent in principle.
This is Q dependent. This is Q dependent, but this is rather small, except maybe for the first sideband, really close to the threshold of your system. Okay. Which is not the case for the molecular. Okay, the molecular phase difference can be really can change a lot. Okay, and in fact, so what you can see here is that, okay, let's just forget of this thing. What you see is that by measuring the intensity or the height of the sideband changing tau, you get the phase difference from the two neighboring harmonics. Okay, and this is really the basis of the rabbit technique. Okay. So this is how the experiment works. So this is exactly more or less what we except that now they don't really select the harmonics. Okay, so you have the generating field, so going through this delay line, it's focused on the generating gas here. Okay. Then you get the harmonics. There's right by prime remove the generating laser here, and then these harmonics they are focused onto a gas, and with a time of flight spectrometer they measure the electron energy, the ionized electron energy. So if you do that, what you end up, for example, you have your two harmonics and you get your two peaks here. Okay, if you have more than two harmonics, you have many of these peaks. Now you can see that in this mirror there is a small hole, and this small hole, this is the way they have this dressing field. There is also a delay line here, and but this one is really very sensitive. As you can see, that they can move it around. This is five nanometers. To get a delta T of 400 attosecond. And this is recombined, and what you get the siphon in between. And now by changing the position of this mirror, this piezoelectric mirror, you have a change of the height of the siphon. Okay? So with that, you can, if you have many harmonics, and you change the delay, this is what you get. So the red lines correspond to what we call the harmonic peak. So this is a photoelectron ionized by the harmonic. Okay? And they are intense. And in between each of these, you get the yellow lines. And the yellow lines correspond to the siphons. And as you can see, that the intensity of the siphons are oscillating. Okay, and in fact, if the phase difference here between two neighboring harmonics were constant, what you would observe is that they will be completely aligned. This maximum. Okay, and in fact, it's not that easy, but there is a slight shift here. Okay, and the slight shift can be really explained. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you get the oscillation at twice the laser period because of this 2 omega here, and in fact this the harmonics, they don't have exactly the same phase, okay? Because this is the attosecond chirp of the harmonics. In fact, if you look at this three-step model, the electron has to go away and comes back, okay? And when it goes away, when it comes back, he has acquired kinetic energy, and depending on this kinetic energy, he emits a certain harmonic, and so the time of excursion depends on the harmonic. Okay, and the phase difference is related to the time of emission of the harmonics. Okay, so therefore, and you can see here, you have different, let's say, different trajectory, and this is the harmonic order here, and you can see that the harmonic order depends on the more or less linearly here. As a function of the harmonics, and in fact, for a given harmonics, you have two trajectories that give exactly the same kinetic energy. This is what is called the short here. This peak here, they correspond to this trajectory. This is a short trajectory, so the electron is emitted close to zero, not zero field, but at rather low field when the field is coming back already. Okay, and the electron is really pushed away rather fast to the toward the neutrons. This is a short trajectory, and the long trajectory, they are emitted close to the just after the maximum of the field of the oscillation, okay, and it goes really away and comes back at a much longer time, okay.
So this is
a classical picture, yeah, but it works quite well.
So the initial momentum distribution is
This is a 1D calculation, and there is zero because it comes from tunneling.
Tunneling.
So it's x equals, it's the initial condition are x equals zero at the ionization, and the velocity is zero. Okay. And in fact, so you have two trajectories, as I said, the long and the short and the long trajectories, and you get this linear chirp more or less, which is positive for the short and negative for the long. And what is important is that due to phase matching, so this macroscopic effects, we observe only the short trajectory, okay, which are emitted along the
What exactly do you mean by chirp in this context?
You get emission time which are slightly different. So the phase of the they are emitted at a different time.
So you're talking about the slopes of these curves.
Yeah.
Positive, right?
Yeah, positively, yeah.
So you're saying phase actually varies linearly in this.
The phase, yeah.
So that there is effectively a frequency.
Yeah. No, the phase. No, this is no. The phase difference here. No, you have a quadratic chirp. For the phase. The time increases. The time of emission of the harmonics is linear, and the phase, this is the integral of this, so you get a quadratic chirp. Depending on the phase, it varies quadratically.
So can you explain again why you don't see the long trajectory?
Because of macroscopic effects, you can show that the phase matching between what you have, that you have electrons, you have different phase effects, okay, for the macroscopic. You have the propagation of your laser. You have to look at the propagation of your laser and also of your harmonics, okay. And you have dephasing effect like the electron, okay. You have also a jump of pi, which is not you have a variation of pi, which is a GUI phase, because your laser is focused. And when you add all this phase to look if it's coherent, where is the coherent part, and the coherent part goes along the laser for the short trajectory. You also have the long trajectory, but they are coherent, they are on phase outside the propagation of the laser. This gives you an annular emission. But we get what is along the propagation. Okay? You have all the dephasing effects due to mainly it's the electron. And you also have the dipole, which gives a phase, and you have the GUI phase. Yeah?
You have chirp pulse and the three-step model may break down, of course. Huh? The reconstruction of D may be not unique. Just thinking.
Why?
If the chirp is sufficiently big. So you made a comparison by comparing to the time-dependent Schrödinger equation?
His object changes with time, yes.
Yeah, but it doesn't. No, the object, yeah.
No.
Okay. They can get this chirp from the rabbit technique, right?
This chirp? Yes, this is what we measure. We measure the phase difference here. With the rabbit technique, we measure this phase difference here. And this phase, this is really the phase of the harmonic of this signal here. So this is the phase of the dipole. If we suppose that we don't have this problem of coherence of the non-perfectly aligned molecules. Okay? Yes.
So come back to the long trajectories. If you look not on axis but off axis.
Off axis.
Then you would see the.
Yeah, off axis you see the you see the long trajectory.
Yeah. Usually people just change the focus and draw an
arc. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, what you they choose the position of the molecular or the atomic beam which create the harmonics in the right position to get the phase matching of the short trajectory along, on axis. You have to put, if I'm correct, and move after the focus, the beam.
The locus is before
yeah,
the gen.
Yeah. To get the short trajectory phase matched, you have to put the jet after the focus to get that the GUI phase mainly compensate all the let's say bad phase or the decoherent phase. Okay. So now we have a tool to measure both the amplitude and the phase, and also they can measure the polarization, but for the reconstruction we have that, we didn't use the polarization because they didn't have it. Okay? But we need to align the molecule. Okay? And the way they align the molecules, this is a short pulse induced alignment. So they wanted to have aligned molecules, but last Martin showed the first week during the conference for people who were there. He showed the experiment where it was an adiabatic alignment. So they had the aligned pulse along for the full experiment, and they were shining the laser within the aligned laser. Here we wanted to have aligned molecules without the aligned laser. Okay? So the idea that you shine a rather short laser pulse at moderate intensity, so it's 10 to the 13. Okay? And what you create is you create a rotational wave packet of your molecule. And you can see that sometimes you cannot read and sometimes you can read what is going on. So you align your molecules, okay? You have this alignment revival. Okay, and this was observed in 2003, and you can see here you have your aligned pulse here. So after the pulse, the molecules are aligned, and then you have the de-alignment, and after half of the period of rotation, you get this alignment here back. Okay, and just after you have the molecule is aligned, it's not really aligned, but it's at 90 degrees. From the polarization of your laser, okay, and goes on, okay. So the idea is that you have two laser, you have the aligned laser, and then you have the generating laser. You shine the first laser at a certain polarization. You wait 4.137 picosecond, and then you send the second one at a different angle. Okay, and you know that the molecules are aligned. Not perfectly aligned, but they're aligned. And if the coolest the molecules are, you get the rather good alignment. And I think it's better than 15. I think it's 10%.
The cooler they are?
Yeah. Yeah, the cooler they are, there is less collision and less dephasing of the rotational wave packet. And I think that it's in Gila they have the best. No, it's you.
No, in Gila we have the best everything.
Yeah. Okay.
No, my impression was you need some distribution of rotational states to get a good alignment. If you have a single eigenstate in your initial state, then you don't get such sharp alignment.
No, but you create before you create by the laser. So if you start with something rather hot, the laser is not strong enough to create a good rotational wave packet.
What also happens when you make this hotter, these alignment revivals become relatively narrow.
Yeah.
So it's.
Yeah, but it's the maximum here is more than 100 femtosecond. You can use 20 femtosecond laser to create your harmonic. So even if you reduce the time here, you still have enough, and the molecules are quite Yeah, they are quite aligned.
Who is this one there? Is this nitrogen or something?
This, I think this is nitrogen, yes. And you can see that the ionization is realigned here along the polarization of the aligned laser. Here, this is just after, this is at 90 degrees, and on the half a cycle after, they get still the alignment. So the molecules are quite well aligned along the polarization axis of the first laser.
So they measured all the way around?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, what they do is that they align the molecules, and then they shine a very strong laser to have ionization, and they collect the electron. And you can see that they are main, this is Coulomb explosion. Coulomb explosion, sorry. It's double ionization, so they get the Coulomb explosion, and they look at the fragment, and you can see that the fragment, they are really along this the axis of the alignment. Okay, so as I said, so we have to get rid of all these terms here to get that one, and with the rabbit technique we have this. We have the phase, okay? So now it's a rather difficult task to compute the scattering wave, so even people like Chris Green, the Chris Green group, or Robert Lucchese. Yes,
sorry. There was one important question I should have asked. These are measured in coincidence, or they're just measured the yields on both sides?
Coincidence, I think so. No? No, this is one side?
I don't think it's coincidence, no.
It's not a coincidence, right?
I think it's one.
It is coincidence.
I don't know.
It doesn't have to be if you have a diatomic.
No, it's a diatomic, so you don't care.
Well, they arrive.
You don't need a coincidence No, because it's N2 plus that a Coulomb explodes. So what you get in one side, you get it on the other side. So you don't need.
But they have the same kinetic energy. Okay, so
we can work. Yeah, sure.
It's important.
Yeah, so what I say is that, okay, the tomography really needs to have, to get a good reconstruction using the Fourier transform. What you need is that you need the plane wave approximation. Yes?
Can I ask you, in principle you could, if you had the scattering wave function of one electron, let's stay with one electron.
Yeah.
And then you could expand it in plane waves, and yeah, you will see that you will have the sum of the many very different orbitals, and you will have the coefficients. You can do it for every term separately, I mean the Fourier transform, and in this way you could get a result which is beyond plane waves, as long as it is expandable.
But you'll have wave vectors corresponding to energies different than the harmonic energies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, we've written a formula which is kind of obvious that if you have the scattering, complete set of scattering wave functions, you can do the inversion, the transform with those, and do the reconstruction.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can rephrase that as a Fourier integral, but then you'll have off-shell contributions.
Yeah, but it's actually unique. If you have the scattering wave function,
you don't have the information. You don't have enough information.
Unless you really got the full scattering wave function.
No, I mean you have to have it. I mean, they have to do something.
Yeah, then you don't need to go through plane waves. You can just use the scattering wave.
Okay,
function.
Fine. If you can do
but
I wanted to say, if you expand it in plane waves, you will see maybe which orbitals also. Oh, okay, then you will need a coupling between the
You need lots of things. Yeah. The idea that it's the most, even if there are approximations, but the most straightforward from what you get from the experiment to what you reconstruct. If you put, let's say, too much of theory, it's at the end you the idea is that you don't get what you put too much inside, I would say. So if you plug in the HOMO, you get the HOMO at the end, sort of. So,
anyways, your experiment is actually possible, at least in principle. Yeah, so if you can control which part of the scattering wave function comes there,
yeah,
and then measure the complete spectrum for each part of the scattering solution which comes back, then in principle you have enough information to do what you propose. But this is not what is done, they measure everything in single shot.
Yeah.
In principle, yes, it's a very hard experiment, terribly hard.
But then that transfer function is actually going to be the Fourier transform of the scattering states, I believe. So
it's exactly what you propose.
It's exactly what Chris said. You end up having to know the scattering states. If you could measure that information, you could do that. Or if you know it by theory, you could do that. But it's functionally equivalent to knowing the scattering states.
Yeah.
So this is the whole weakness of this experiment. There's no energy resolution, essentially.
We measure harmonics by harmonics, so we know the energy of the electron coming back. But what we need all the information to reconstruct the wave function.
But you don't know from what orbit it's coming from in the fraction. Separate them out.
We know.
We're measuring minus one, and there is some fraction.
Yeah. Yeah, but the split, in our case, we are helped by the symmetry. But if you don't have symmetry, it's true that you can be real big trouble to reconstruct the wave function.
By the way, when I say weakness, it's not a criticism.
No, you're sure.
It's relative to the binary E2E stuff, which has been on for years and years.
Yeah, but,
momentum and energy resolution.
Nevertheless, as the first step of the process of the harmonic generation is tunneling. Tunneling is very sensitive to the energy of the initial state, because it governs the height of the tunneling of the barrier. So there is a tunneling action like a filter. So you filter in some sense the contributions of different orbitals if they are not degenerate, obviously.
Yeah, that's very important. Without that, you would see gibberish.
So I will show you now the experimental measure in N2. So this is what they got. So both for the harmonic signal. So this is what they got at Saclay. So they have this pink curve. This is argon, which is the reference atom for N2, has the same ionization potential as N2. And here you have the N2 harmonic spectrum as a function of the angle from 0 to 90 degrees. Here, okay. And here, this is the same, but for the phase of the harmonics, and they got the phase from the rabbit technique. Yeah. Yes.
I'm actually pretty interested in that phase. Why? It seems like you've got one line, which is just the chirp, and then after you reach a certain energy, maybe you're probing the interior of the molecule.
In fact, you can see that all these things here, this change, happens here close to the minimum. And if you look now, if we normalize by argon, this is what we get. Okay? So you get this minimum here around the 25th harmonic, between 23 and 25th function. So this is the spectrum, normalized by argon. And here this is the dipole phase, okay? And what we put here is that we put all the phases for the 17th harmonic to zero, equals to zero. So we have an arbitrary, because we know only the phase difference, so we have to choose one of the phase, and we decided that to put everything at zero here. Okay, and you can see, obviously, that the phase is not zero before the minimum, and then pi after the minimum. Okay, we have huge variation, especially here around this minimum. The phase can go to pi over 2. You can see that there is sort of a jump of pi from this point to here, but before you get the phase that goes to around pi over 2.
This yes? is your analysis, right? The Itatani experiment, they assume something. Could you remind me what they assume? Didn't they assume a phase change of pi or something?
For Itatani experiment, at the minimum here, at the 20, around 25 harmonics, they assume a change of pi, saying that before the phase is zero, and then it's pi.
So you're saying that was incorrect?
As you can see, yes. This is an approximation. You can see that before this is zero and then this is pi, which is something like that. But
But you can move your curves arbitrarily up and down.
We can move our curves arbitrarily up and down. Yeah, we put this here to zero here. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So why did it work so well if the assumption was
basically? This is a miracle. This is a big miracle. I would say.
So for each angle, it's a different overall phase that you have to choose, or is it one for all the different angles?
We choose for the 17th harmonic that the phase for all angle be zero. This is arbitrary,
nine different.
Yeah. We put them, this is why they all end up at this point. So we choose that they all have a phase so it equals to zero.
In principle, you can measure all
the phases. There is no way to get both the phase difference at the seven angle as a function of the harmonics and to get what they do in NRC. They get for certain harmonic as a function of the angle, but it's quite difficult to get both. To get both on the same in the same series of measures.
You only have to stitch it up at once.
You need one reference, and I think that we check that the around the 17th harmonic, the phase of all the function of the angle is rather flat. We check that. Yeah, it's Yann Meraz did the experiment. I think that it's quite flat. Yes?
Just so I'm clear. So this phase here, can you relate it to the phase here? That which exactly phase is?
Here. This is this quantity.
It's just the harmonic phase.
This is a harmonic phase.
That's what you're plotting there.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're now assigning that phase to D.
Now it's a D. Yeah, but because we took the square root, we divided by the argon, and we divided by the phase of argon, which is more or less linear, but we divided by the phase of argon. Yes?
A naive question. This comes from the experiment, but can you calculate it with simple molecular orbital?
I will show you.
Okay.
So we are making the plane wave. We are making the plane wave approximation, and in fact, what we wanted to test. Okay, so as I told you, the plane wave approximation gives you, because of the symmetry of your orbital, give you either a pure real dipole when you make the plane wave approximation. Because, for example, the HOMO is symmetric, is a CMIG orbital. So you can show that if you make the plane wave approximation, your dipole is purely imaginary due to symmetry reason. Okay? And for example, for the HOMO minus 1, this is purely real in the plane wave approximation. Okay? So what we wanted to test, and we didn't have at this time the... So we couldn't compute the scattering wave, but so we say, okay, let's try to have some Coulomb test. Okay, so we try to compare the dipole computed with the plane wave approximation to the dipole computed with a plane wave approximation with Coulomb wave, hydrogenic Coulomb wave. Okay, so what we did is that this is, so on the left you have the HOMO of N2 with a Hartree Fock calculation, and we use a one center slater approximation of this HOMO. So this is not perfect, but it gives the flavor of what we observe. Okay, so you can see that the internuclear axis is there, and where it's wide, this is more or less the position of the nuclei.
Where is this cut through?
This is cut through this.
So it includes the nuclear axis?
Yeah, along the nuclear axis. You can see that the nuclei are here and here, okay? And here this is a projection on a plane, and this is a cut of this curve here, and you get along the nuclear axis. Okay?
What is this star?
This is, okay, so what we are using to compute, so the idea is that we want to look at the difference between plane wave and Coulomb wave, okay? This was our approximation of the scattering wave. So the idea is that we compute the dipole either by a plane wave. So let's say x, for example, or y, whatever, with the HOMO. Okay, and we use here, or we use Coulomb wave function x psi HOMO. Okay, and this Coulomb wave, so this is really for hydrogen with a Z star. So we could change the charge of the hydrogen atom. So if it's 1, you get hydrogen Coulomb wave function. Yeah. If it's 0, for example, you get the plane wave.
Yeah, so you use 1 or 0?
1, 0, and we play with that.
Between 0 and 1?
Even more. But we almost play with 0 and 1, but in between. Okay? And so, just give you, maybe not. Okay, the thing is, okay, we get the sum, infinity, I sigma L, okay. Of Z star, okay, and the one of the important parameters, this is a Coulomb phase, and this is the argument of the gamma function of L plus 1 plus I Z star over K. Okay, and this function here goes to the AIKR if you take Z star equals 0. Okay? Yeah, sure. Yeah, but it gives you rather good information on what is going on in our case, I would say. Right.
But people have used these models to try to get polarization.
Yeah.
It's certainly not plane wave. Hmm? It's certainly not plane wave.
It's certainly not plane wave. No, but we wanted to see what is going on with the phase of the, because the problem is that when you look at this phase, in fact, the problem is that when you have such a phase, it's quite difficult to understand what is going on here. Okay, for the Itatani experiment, just say okay, 0 pi. You know that with your dipole, you get a real wave function. The problem is that with this kind of thing, we get a non-real wave function. We get a wave function, and I will show you, which has a real part and imaginary part. And the real part and imaginary part, they don't do the same. And we were puzzled for a long, long time on what was going on with that thing. Okay, and so the idea that, so we thought that maybe the scattering wave was adding some phase, some strange phase, or, and so the, so this is why we use these things. Okay, and here, so what we did, so this is first the plane, so we compare the plane wave approximation for the two HOMO of N2. So this is what we get. So this is, as I told you, the dipole is purely imaginary. Okay, you get zero here for the real part due to symmetry. Okay, and here this is the plane wave dipole of our model Slater-like one center of the HOMO. And you can see that it's, they are really close. Okay. You get the same minima here at the same position, and all the structure are here, okay? And here, this is the Coulomb approximation. So we compute the dipole for the fit, for the Slater fit of our HOMO, okay? But for Z star of one, okay? So this is an hydrogen Coulomb wave function. Yes?
What is the range of K you're actually measuring?
Just a second. Give me, well, yeah, 30 seconds, okay? So what you can see is that first, you get a real part and an imaginary part, and the shape, and in fact, this, you can see here that the shape, they are quite the same. So the Coulomb wave, or the Coulomb nature of the scattering wave, doesn't really change the dipole. What gives you, and I will show you for the phase of this dipole, it just gives you a real part, but with the same behavior than the imaginary part. Okay? And this is here. This is what they what we measure here. Okay, what they measure in the experiment. This is a K range, taking the relation between the harmonic energy and the kinetic energy of the returning electron, omega equals p squared over 2. Okay, this is what they did for, in the Itatani experiment. And in fact, the real stuff is that you should take p squared over 2 plus ip. Okay, and it seems that when you do the plane wave, you remove the IP. And in fact, what you can see is that, okay, if you look at this, so this is a plane wave. If you look at this region, what we are taking, you get this minimum here. Okay, and you get more or less the same minimum and the same behavior with the Coulomb wave, but just shifting the relation between the harmonic energy by IP. Okay? And in fact, when we are looking at the phase, okay, I will go a bit faster. So we have here, we compare the dipole phase. So we computed these things here, and now we look at the phase of the dipole. Okay, so the ratio, the ratio for between the imaginary part and the real part. And this is what we get. So this is a plane wave approximation and the Coulomb wave approximation of the dipole for different angles. So we have 0 degrees, 45 degrees, and 90 degrees. Okay? And what you can see is that except for the very, very low values of K, okay, when we get a lot of oscillation, the behavior is more or less identical, except two things, three things. The first one is that, okay, here you have jump from zero of pi at different position here, and they are really jump, okay? And here you get the same jump, but they are smoothed. Okay, the position of the jump are shifted by a quantity delta k, and this corresponds to more or less this IP I told you. Okay, and at the end there is an overall shift of pi over 4. And this pi over 4, this was the reason why for the for the this star equals one, you get more or less the same of the dipole for the real part and the imaginary part with the sign. Okay. Okay. So this is what we got, and so this behavior of the phase couldn't come from the the Coulomb wave. So maybe if we do a scattering wave, we get something different. But I'm not that sure that we will get really big difference, at least in this part of K. Yeah.
I would recommend you look at our J. Fizz camp paper in 2008, which gives some examples. I mean, the Coulomb wave is not a good approximation to the molecular scattering wave.
I agree.
Simply not.
Yeah, sure.
What if you knew the S matrix, though? I mean, maybe this is just the second term in an expansion, that you start with a plane wave, then you go to the Coulomb wave, then you go to the
The Born series of 25 EV electrons is, it's not very
relevant. I'm not sure that the behavior would be that very, very different. I don't know. Well, for the phase I'm talking about.
Anyways, we have to move on. The assumption is basically assumed for the system.
Yeah, okay. So the problem is that we didn't know. And in fact, it comes that the electron does not come only from the HOMO, but from also the HOMO minus 1. Okay, and because they have this symmetry difference, this gives you an overall shift between of pi over 2 of the dipole from the HOMO and the HOMO minus 1. Yes?
This critically depends on the phase accumulated in the continuum being completely independent on the orientation.
Yeah.
So, but of course, you have quadrupole moment.
But you know this is the phase accumulated. Okay, so in fact, due to the symmetry reason, what we have is that the dipole of the HOMO will be purely imaginary, and the HOMO minus one will be purely real. Okay, so they are not mixed. Okay, now you can say they don't have the same energy. In the dipole, in the plane wave approximation. Now you say, okay, the problem is that they don't have the same energy. So they evolve differently when the electron is going out and coming back. So they accumulate phase. And so you can say, okay, now they are mixed. What we see in our experiment is that they accumulate phase depending on the harmonics, but around this is the region we are making the experiment, the phase is close to pi. This is not perfectly pi, but it's close to pi, and plus or minus 0.2 pi. Okay, so there is a bit of mixing due to this phase, but as we are close to pi, they remain more or less separated. Okay.
The amplitudes of the two contributions change with angle also, the relative.
This is what is going on, and this is why the phase is there. So here, this is the HOMO. This is the HOMO coming from the R3 fog here. This is what we reconstruct from the dipole. This is a real part of the wave function by Fourier transform the dipole. Okay, amplitude and phase. This is what we get. Okay, they don't really look the same. We have a change of sign. You get just a second. Okay, this is what we get. Okay, so this is not really good, and this is even worse than it at any. Okay. Okay, this is what we get from the HOMO computing the dipole within the plane wave approximation. Okay, and just restricting ourselves to the k value they measure in the experiment, and this is what we get. And now the agreement is rather good, I would say. Okay, now.
So what was the previous one?
The previous one was really this is the HOMO coming from GAMES or GAMES. We are talking about small range of k values. K value is from point is from 1 to 2, something like that. So this was a small. The sampling, the experiment, they had only 8 8 or 9 harmonics. So 8 or 9 values of k. So this is rather small.
So 1 to 2.
1 to 2, yeah. So two. The delta k is around 0.1.
So as Chris said, that's right in the region of the famous K sigma U resonance and 3 sigma G to K sigma U channel.
This could be a problem,
It's not in the core. Certainly not in the plane.
No. Okay. Another problem is that this is the imaginary part. Okay, so just I went a bit further. Yeah. This is the imaginary part we reconstruct from the experiment, and it was really a big problem because you can see that you don't see any. It's really strange. Okay, and in fact, the idea is that it comes from the homo minus one, but with the wrong symmetry. Let me explain it in 37. Okay, the idea that they measure the dipole only from 0 to 90 degrees, but you need from 0 to 360 degrees. Okay, so to get the three other quadrants, you need a bit of symmetry for N2. Okay, if you don't have a symmetric molecules, you will measure everything, but for N2. So we use a symmetry of N2 to reconstruct the three other quadrants. Okay, the thing is that if you use for the Omo minus one, so you take the Omo minus one from the quantum chemistry code, you compute the dipole from 0 to 90 degrees, and you reconstruct all your angles with the same symmetry of the Omo, so which means that all quadrants are the same. Okay, this is what you get, something which is symmetric. Okay, and it's not the same, but it looks the same as this one. Okay, now so what we can do is that we take the Omo minus one, compute the dipole, but we give him for all the quadrants the right symmetry. This is what we reconstruct, and we do the same for the imaginary part of the dipole, assuming that there is no mixing due between the two, between the Omo and the Omo minus one. And we are helped in the experiment, I would say, by the fact that the phase accumulated by the electron into the continuum is close to pi, so they're still in the different part of the real and the imaginary part for the dipole. And so with that we can reconstruct from the experiment, we can reconstruct the whole density at different time at the recombination time, and you can see that when the whole when the electron leaves the molecules, you get a hole at the other position compared to the molecular axis. Okay, and in fact this weird behavior of the phase, okay, is because as you said it, I think, that, well, you said it, I don't know, I think it's Chris, that you get different ionization depending on the angle. And if we just let's finish, okay. This is the time structure of the harmonic emission from the experiment as a function of the angle. Okay? And we can reconstruct it by playing between the real part and the imaginary part, and by changing the weight between the Omo and the Omo minus one as a function of the angle. And this is what we reconstruct. So something rather similar. This is the weight between the Omo and the Omo minus one. Okay? And you can see that the behavior of this emission is rather close to the one observed in the experiment, assuming they don't mix. So this is why you get this delta phi equals pi over two. Okay? If, for example, they mix strongly, so it's delta phi equals 2, everything is mixed, you can see that this is really totally different to what they observe in the experiment. So what we can say is that in the experiment we can measure, we observe